The increasing incidence of venereal disease in our society is a complex phenomenon which presents special problems and requires comprehensive remedial measures. In discussion with the family physician, Dr. Lawrence B. McNally, are a group of specialists each experienced in a different facet of the management and treatment of venereal disease patients. Dr. Joseph Portnoy, microbiologist and the moderator, Dr. Robert Aikman, obstetrician-gynecologist, Dr. Howard Rotenberg, urologist, and Linda Heisler, a registered nurse in charge of a VD clinic.
I am often asked the question, is it really true that there's an increase or an epidemic of venereal diseases in Canada? Perhaps the best way of answering the question is to indicate that gonorrhea is the commonest infectious disease which is curable by antibiotic therapy. Gonorrhea is probably only second in incidence to the common cold. It affects 1 in 330 persons in the United States. There, of course, has been an increase in other venereal diseases, but not to the same extent as we have seen with gonorrhea. I'd like to ask the panelists whether they too have noticed this increase in their practice. Dr. Robert Aikman is an obstetrician and gynecologist who is responsible for the supervision of an adolescent venereal disease clinic in Montreal. Bob?
Well, I think it depends on what you consider as common. We have, for about 18 months, have been screening all our sexually active teenagers who come to our clinic. And if we take the total number of patients that we've screened, our incidence is quite low, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 to 1.5%. But if we take all the girls who come in complaining of symptoms or claiming to be contacts, then our incidence is considerably higher than that.
Do you have a figure on that? Because I'm interested.
I'm not sure I can give you an exact figure offhand, but I would say it's well over 50 to 60% of our contacts are positive.
Linda Heisler is a nurse responsible for a venereal disease clinic in Montreal. Linda, how do you think our statistics in your clinic compares with the experience at the adolescent clinic?
People who come to our clinic don't come primarily just for venereal infection, and the rate of gonorrhea among our patients has been 22 to 23% of the total population.
I wonder, could I contrast that with the experience in our practice? As you know, I'm in private family practice, and I have heard more about the boom in gonorrhea than I have seen it in my practice, and I practice in a middle-class suburb with a large population of young families with a high percentage of adolescents in the population, although I'm constantly bombarded by requests for birth control assistance, and I see a relatively small percentage of people who come to me, adolescents especially, but who come to me with requests for screening or treatment or diagnosis of venereal disease. And I suspect that at least in major metropolitan areas, they prefer to use more anonymous places like hospitals and venereal disease clinics than private practices.
Thank you, Dr. McNally. Dr. Howard Rotenberg is a urologist who has had some experience in the management of venereal disease problems. Have you too noticed an increase in the incidence of this infection?
From talking with my colleagues, I think the number of patients that we see with venereal disease may be, in fact, diminished. I think patients are not going to their urologist, but they are being seen primarily by the family practitioner, or they are being treated primarily in the specialty clinics. The day where the urologist was very involved in the treatment of gonorrhea, I think, is past. And I think that most urologists are now realizing that in these special clinics, the patients are offered a better diagnosis, treatment, and the follow-up and the search for contacts can be done better than in the urologist's office.
I was wondering, Bob, how do patients present with gonorrhea when they present to you? And you see exclusively female patients.
I'd say most of the patients I've seen who subsequently were proven to have gonorrhea had very little in the way of symptoms. I find it clinically very difficult to distinguish between a discharge that is due to the pill or of a non-specific infectious type as opposed to a gonorrheal infection. And I can only think of one or two patients who ever had a fulminating urethral discharge, females. Cervical symptoms are practically nil, or findings are practically nil. And I just find that I can't rely on my clinical judgment as to whether or not a patient does have gonorrhea. And this is why I think if there's any question, you really have to test microbiologically as to whether or not the disease is present.
Put that another way, Bob, and say that gonorrhea is practically an asymptomatic disease in women?
Yeah, I think.
Yes, I think in fact it is.
The U.S. Public Health Service has published statistics on this, and they've stated that about 80% of women with gonorrhea have a completely asymptomatic infection. And the only way of finding out whether these patients have it or not is to do cultures. But, Bob, you mentioned that you can't distinguish on the character of the vaginal discharge as to whether or not you're dealing with gonorrhea. I was wondering then, how do you select which patients you are going to test for gonorrhea?
Well, then I think it becomes a question of either establishing a large screening program, such as we run in our adolescent clinic, but in your own private practice, I think this is extremely difficult. None of us have the facilities in our office to do this type of thing. And then I rely largely on either people who come in claiming to be contacts or worried about having contracted gonorrhea, or patients who have a resistant infection of another source. And the one that jumps to mind immediately is Trichomonas. I've seen at least a half a dozen people in the last year who had Trichomonas proven by culture, by slide, hanging drop suspension, with all the clinical characteristics of a trichomonal infection in the female, and didn't respond to treatment. And it was only after the first two or three times that I saw this, I started testing for gonorrhea, and they've all had gonorrhea. And so I think this is one of the first clues to someone who may have a concomitant infection that is interfering with your treatment of the primary.
What do you
suspected.
Think the relationship is?
Well, I consider Trichomonas as a venereal disease as well, and obviously much less virulent than gonorrhea. But certainly, it's in my practice, its main mode of transmission is by sexual contact. But it very rarely doesn't respond to treatment. I mean, specific treatment with metronidazole. And I think the patient who doesn't respond or who keeps coming back and you know their boyfriend has taken or her husband has taken the treatment as well, then you have to put gonorrhea very high on your list
of suspicions.
How does the
presence of gonorrhea, which you found in every one of these six cases, interfere with the resolution of the trichomonas?
I have no idea. No idea,
well,
unless there is some sort of interplay.
It's a very interesting clinical clue. Look for gonorrhea and resistant trichomonas.
Well, I think that you can't use clinical presentation in order to think about it, because if 80% of your patients are asymptomatic, you have to think about it when they don't have symptoms. And I think you really have to think about it in the patient who is a high-risk patient. And of course, anyone who is having sex is susceptible, even if they think they're having it with only one partner, because their partner might be having it with many other people and they might not be aware of it. So I think that perhaps in this day of the epidemic nature of venereal disease, I think anyone who has a vaginal discharge is having sexual activity with more than one partner, or someone who has an infection which is resistant to therapy should certainly be cultured. Ideally, I would say, is that every patient, every female patient with a vaginal discharge should have a culture for gonorrhea if they are in the sexually active ages, particularly in the high incidence age, up until about 25 or 30.
I would wonder if you could sell that to people in family practice like myself. Joe, that's a very interesting and statement, which you can probably defend. But as Bob will point out, many vaginitides present with very classic pictures of either manilial vaginitis or of trichomonal vaginitis. Where the clinical picture of these two clear-cut entities is precise, I wonder if you would still hold that view.
Well, our experience in our clinic has been that physicians do not have the clinical judgment to be able to decide when and when not to do the culture. And we often see patients who've been to obstetricians and gynecologists with a very high and good reputation, in whom they've actually requested studies for gonorrhea, but I think the problem is one of expense and lack of facility. And I think that if this were made available to family physicians, to obstetricians and gynecologists, if the government should make this available and much easier access to it, I think more people would use it. And I think the best way to treat a patient is to know what they have, and that's culture. Bob?
Well, just while you're talking about that, I think most of us have tried to avail ourselves of the government culture system, and from your experience, how accurate is this? I mean, the government does provide, at least in this province, a mechanism whereby you can take a culture and send it to a government lab, but is that really accurate?
Well, we have for a long time recognized that the best way of making a diagnosis, because the organism is so fragile, is to plate it directly onto the appropriate media and to place it in the incubator as quickly as possible. But recent studies have shown that specifically developed transport media, which contain antibiotics to inhibit the growth of non-pathogenic organisms such as the coliforms and other Neisseria and Candida, has allowed adequate transport of these specimens, so that if you use the right type of transport media, one can often find this approach very useful. We've noticed something else which we found very useful in our clinic, and that is about 60% of women who have gonorrhea who've come to us have had a positive Gram stain. Now, that facility is certainly available to all, and it's certainly a very high proportion, and I think if physicians would make more use of that, it might be of some help to them as well. This is in females. We've had about 60% positive Gram stains. I'd like to ask Howard, the problem in males comparable to females. How do men present with gonorrhea when they have this?
When men have florid cases of gonorrhea, it's difficult to miss the diagnosis. Clinically, they'll have purulent discharge, and they'll have irritative lower urinary tract symptoms. I'd just like to refer a question back to you. What has been your experience with males who, can a male have gonorrhea and not have any symptoms? What has been your experience?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because we've recently completed a survey for the presence of asymptomatic gonococcal infection in the males who attend our clinic. These are people who come largely as contacts of positive females. And we found that about 50% of our male contacts are positive for gonorrhea. And of these, half have asymptomatic infection. The total incidence in our clinic is about 12%, 12 to 15% of asymptomatic gonococcal infection in males. And this means completely without any symptoms whatsoever. The male partner is unaware that he has this infection and can transmit the infection to other people over prolonged periods of time. And we have one person in whom we have documented the presence of asymptomatic infection for a period of some 158 days. I think it's a problem which is becoming much more apparent, and I think physicians should become more aware of the presence of asymptomatic infection. And again, in the male, the only accurate way to make this diagnosis is through culture.
Well, to take that a step further, you have asked Dr. Aikman if he can select out from his patient population those who he thinks might be most liable to have this infection. Since you've described such a high percentage of asymptomatic gonorrhea in males, what criteria would you use to determine which males would be eligible for culture, excluding the contacts that are an obvious group?
I think that any male who presents with symptoms should be cultured, even if he has a past history of non-specific urethritis and has been treated for this in the past, because his subsequent urethritis might be a new exposure to a different partner and he might have picked up gonorrhea. In fact, I remember one case of a patient who presented with Reiter syndrome and whom we had checked out for gonorrhea and found him to be negative on three occasions. And then about 4 months later, he was referred back to us because of the persistent unrelenting discharge. And on re-examination, he was found to be positive for gonorrhea. And on careful questioning, although this man was married, he admitted to having frequent extramarital sexual experiences, and in fact, one of his recent contacts had gonorrhea. So he had a non-specific urethritis, or a urethritis associated with a Reiter syndrome, and then on top of that developed an acute gonococcal urethritis. It's interesting, in the male, the smear is even more reliable than in the female, and we found approximately 92 or 91% of our patients, male patients with gonorrhea, will have a positive Gram stain to confirm the diagnosis. So that in the male population, it's much easier. In fact, even men with asymptomatic infection will often have a positive Gram stain.
I suppose you're relating that percentage-wise to culture diagnosis as being 100%.
Right.
Now, in those offices where you might not have or might not choose to do Gram staining, what do you think the reliability is of taking a culture with a cotton-tipped swab? We don't have special transport media in my area. We have a tube made of a soft plastic substance with a little glass vial at the bottom that you break the glass vial when you put the Q-tip in, and it humidifies the tip of the Q-tip, and we send it on to the lab by the patient. We have the patient carry it over to the lab, and we get a lot of negative results, and I often wonder what is lost in transit.
I think if you would do a Gram stain at the same time, you don't have to do it yourself, but if you take the swab and smear it on a slide and have the patient bring the slide to the lab and request a Gram stain on that, you will find very often that your Gram stain will be positive, and you'll be able to check the results of your culture on the Gram stain, because you would expect at least 90% of your males with gonorrhea to have a positive smear and about 60% of your females to have this positive smear. So you can actually check the lab and find out whether there's something wrong. The bacteriologic diagnosis of gonorrhea is a difficult one, or it could be a simple one, and the best of laboratories have had problems with it. In fact, in the last year or so, there have been 4 papers written on methods of differentiating gonorrhea from other Neisseria species. And in this day and age, if 4 separate procedures are published in 1 year, this usually implies that other people are having a lot of trouble with it as well. So that the lab, too, can have problems. And I think when one treats patients, one has to put all these things together. You get whatever help you can from the lab, but you've got to use clinical judgment as well. Linda, I'd like to ask you, what has been your experience with some of these patients who present with venereal infections? How do they seem to react when they are told that they have gonorrhea?
Some people accept gonorrhea as another infection and they want to get it over with and treat it properly. But many people have a lot of bad feelings about having the infection, which doesn't come out on the initial contact with them. And only after you've sat down and explained the infection to them do a lot of their fears and bad feelings about having gonorrhea come out. And these feelings have to be dealt with, and the patient has to be allowed to speak about these feelings, otherwise they carry them over and they can affect the relationship with a permanent partner or, you know, future sexual relationships. We've had experience in the clinic with people who've had such difficulty accepting the fact they've had gonorrhea that they've had to be referred to psychiatry.
How do these patients, once they're told that they have gonorrhea and they're explained the importance of having their contacts examined, how do you encourage them or explain to them this need, and do they cooperate, and do they bring their contacts in to be examined?
I find that initially when a person is asked for their contacts, they become very defensive, and unless somebody they've had sex with is going to be a future partner sexually for them, very often they don't care about having that person checked out. Sometimes this is a result of not knowing exactly what gonorrhea is and what happens to people who don't get infected. What I do is I explain the infection, and I explain what happens to women who are essentially asymptomatic when they don't get treated, what happens to males.
Is there any way that you can bring some pressure, legal pressure, on patients to reveal contacts?
There's very little legal pressure. There's legally, contacts have to be brought in within 15 days after a person is told that he has gonorrhea. But this isn't reinforced because there aren't facilities to reinforce this.
If I could speak to the business of tracing contacts, I have a family practice in a suburb with a lot of young couples, a middle-class suburb, with very mobile males who travel all over the country on sales and other, and they often obtain their illness outside the city, and after a plane trip or business trip here or there, and this complicates the problem of tracing contacts and must be one of the reasons why the disease is so prevalent, because the contacts are often unreachable by at least within the confines of one practice or one venereal disease unit.
That's a very good point. Bob, what has been your experience with contact follow-up?
As a gynecologist, I usually don't treat the other half of the partnership, but I encourage them. We provide our patients who have diagnosed gonorrhea with the names of urologists to get in touch with, or for their partner to get in touch with. And told specifically what the infection is, and so on. We all realize that it's a reportable disease, but in my length of time in practice, I've never seen any way for me to report it to any specific authority. And I think most doctors don't report their cases of gonorrhea because they don't know where to report it to. There's no form provided for a doctor to do this on. There's no set agency that we're advised we must report to, and I think this is probably one of the reasons why so many people, again, even the ones that are local contacts, go unrecognized. But for this reason, too, I think it's important for facilities such as yours that specializes in venereal disease per se and has the facilities and the personnel that can attempt to trace these contacts. It's important. If you go into a urologist office or family practitioner's office and expect his nurse to start phoning up people all over the city, it's just, you can't do it. It's impractical. Most of us can't even cope with our own patient load, let alone, expanding our facilities. Under those circumstances, I think you have to refer either to a urologist, a gynecologist, or a venereal disease clinic.
Sometimes, though, when there is an easy way for a patient's contacts to be dealt with, such as a nurse calling without giving that person's name, it sort of relieves a lot of the burden on the person who comes. His responsibility is taken away once he gives the name of his contact, which is the most important thing, or his contacts.
How do you specifically approach that situation where you have the names of contacts? You're the first person to inform the contact that they have the infection.
What I do is I explain to the person that I'm going to call their contacts without giving their name, and this is very often reciprocal, because when that contact is called, if he has an infection, he has very likely to have had sex with somebody else, so this is carried through for him. And once a person's name is mentioned and their phone number, there's more cooperation and the tone is much easier. And we've had experience with people who are called that do come into the clinic. At first they're frightened, they're angry, and once they've found out what kind of infection they're in for, that they may have nothing, and they may have something, they're very glad to have been called.
Larry, you mentioned before the problem of the patient who comes to see you after a trip and he had exposure on his trip, and he comes back with a urethral discharge which proved to be a gonorrhea. But since he had been back, he'd had sex with his wife. How do you cope with that situation?
Well, you have just fingered one of the most delicate problems in family medicine, and this is a very potentially explosive situation in which you have to look beyond the already very important issue of dealing with the disease and its contacts. Of course, you have to look at the stability and the potential for future mutual satisfaction in that relationship. And I don't like to deal with people under false pretenses. The usual thing is the male, since he's usually the person who brought the disease into the couple, although not always, would like you to somehow finagle his wife into coming down under some other pretext, and you could just diagnose it en passant or diagnose something else and give her the shot for some. And I dislike very much doing this for personal reasons, as well as the fact that probably implies to the fellow that this is the way that business is going to be conducted in my office and in his relationship, and I don't think that's very good. So that's not necessarily a stand on extramarital sex. It's a stand on honesty, I suppose, as much as anything else. But what I try to get him to do is to talk about it to his wife. I try to get him to communicate with his wife about it, to speak to her about it, to tell her, I mean, it's a reality, there's no getting away from it. That is not always successful, but remarkably, it is. I would say in maybe 25% of cases, the wife comes, and the other issues, I don't see the wife, and the issue dies there, I suppose. So it's not a very satisfactory solution, but I suppose there isn't any completely satisfactory way of dealing with that problem.
Bob, how do you handle the female patient who comes in with gonorrhea and has had sex without the knowledge of her husband, and she might have infected him?
It's, in my experience, has been very rare. Most of my patients have been single who have had gonorrhea with one or more sexual contacts. In 3 or 4 years, I've only had one patient, I think, who was married and had gonorrhea and actually contracted it from her husband, not the other way around. I would think that would be a much harder problem for a couple to deal with, just on an emotional basis, because I think men tolerate infidelity in their partners much less well than women tolerate their male partners being unfaithful. But it, as Larry says, it's a real problem, and it doesn't just confine itself to the disease. It involves the whole sexual and non-sexual relationship between the couple.
I've been troubled with the same feelings that Larry had expressed in terms of honesty in the relationship and what is the right and wrong thing to do under the circumstances, but my approach differs perhaps a little bit from what Larry described. What I do is I tell the male or the person to go home and tell his wife that he's having a problem. He's having discharge or he's having burning, or and explain to her that he is having a problem. Then to tell her that the doctor would like to see her and see whether or not he might have gotten the infection from her. And what I do is I examine the wife, and I do my cultures, and I tell her that there is a little infection on her cervix and that I'm going to give her the treatment to get rid of the infection. Now, each step, I don't think I've told a lie. I haven't told the complete truth, but I haven't told a lie. I think the women have the opportunity of requesting more information if they so desire. And I would say that in the many, many patients that I've treated, there's only been one case where the woman really wanted to know what she had. Very often they just accept that, and it's real easy. There's no problem whatsoever, because the woman understands that very often they know that they have vaginal discharges, and they can understand that maybe there's a problem in that. And I found that approach to be very helpful and very successful, actually. I'd like to ask Linda, who's had about 2.5 years experience now in running a venereal disease clinic, what type of patients do you find come to the clinic? Are they young people? Are they old people? What type of social background are they from?
Usually the social background is, we have a very good cross-section of people who come. They're students, they're professional people, they're unemployed people, they're secretaries, lawyers. I think every group of people really have come to the clinic. The age distribution is about 50% between 18 to 24 years of age. The youngest patient we've had is 13, and that's about 15% between 13 to 17. The rest is 25% between 25 to 35, and 10% between 36 to 63, which is our oldest patient with gonorrhea positive.
What happens when a patient comes to the clinic, let's say the male patient, what type of investigation does he have to undergo?
Each male patient gets a VDRL. He gets a urethral smear, which is red within about 15 minutes after being taken, a urethral and a throat culture for gonorrhea, which is incubated almost immediately, and if indicated, a rectal culture.
In whom do you do the throat cultures and in whom do you do the rectal cultures?
We do the throat cultures on everybody when they first come to the clinic, and on rectal cultures, either if the doctor feels that a rectal culture might be indicated, or if the patient requests it, or if we know it's to be a homosexual contact, or if a patient complains of a rectal problem.
What is the frequency of positive throat cultures, Linda?
It's been quite low, the yield of positive throat cultures, 2% in our clinic.
What about the rectal cultures?
The rectal cultures has been higher. It's been about 13%. And cervical cultures, 90%, urethral cultures, 70%. In sites where only one site was positive, the yield is from the urethra, 7% in women, 22% only from the cervix, 1% only from the male, and less than 1% only from the throat.
How does the doctor do the urethral culture in the clinic? How does he take this culture?
At first, before the doctor does anything, he explains to the patient what he's going to do. Many people have preconceived ideas of a very painful examination. He takes a sterile cotton swab and introduces it about a quarter of an inch into the urethra and just rests it there. He takes it out and plates it on Thayer Martin and then puts it on a glass slide.
And what type of examination does the female patient get when she comes to the clinic?
The female patient has a VDRL as well as a male. The female patient has a urethral, rectal, cervical, and throat culture, plated also immediately on Thayer Martin, and a cervical smear. As well, the doctor takes a hanging drop with each female patient, and then any other tests that are indicated.
Could I interject?
Yes.
What percentage of your rectal swabs in females are positive?
13%.
Is that only rectal? I mean.
No, only rectal. 1% in females.
The figures on the rectal swabs have varied depending on the series one looks at. The Thayer Martin medium is a chocolate agar medium that contains vancomycin, colistin, and nystatin in it. And unfortunately, when one does a rectal culture, the number of coliform organisms are so high that this medium doesn't particularly inhibit, and even though the gonococcal organism can be present, it often is not recognized. To overcome that, people have incorporated trimethoprim into this medium. And if one uses the Thayer Martin plus trimethoprim in the medium, the yield is much higher, and we hope to go on to this medium and test it out. But in some series, 30 to 40% of rectal cultures from women are positive. And one can correlate the incidence of rectal gonorrhea with the practice of rectal intercourse. As well, we're also having seeing the same problem with gonococcal pharyngitis or gonorrhea of the throat. Now, 2 years ago, King Holmes from Seattle reported at a meeting that there were 6 cases or so of gonococcal pharyngitis in the literature, and he was going to add 150 cases more. And since that time, he subsequently stated that about 30% of women who have oral genital contact with infected male partners will have positive throat cultures. However, in these situations, the throat culture can be intermittently positive. The other thing, there's a practical aspect to this problem, because gonococcal proctitis and gonococcal pharyngitis requires more intensive treatment, which we'll come on to in a little while. I'd like to perhaps move on now to treating patients. There's a lot of controversy in the literature as to which is the best drug to use, how much to give of it, how long to give it. In fact, if one looks through the literature in the last year, there have been many, many trials with many, many drugs. And I was just wondering, Larry, what type of treatment do you give your patients?
We use intramuscular penicillin G still.
Procaine.
That's right. We give 1.2 million units to the males and 2.4 million units to the females. But of course, we groan every time we have to give this to a patient because of the high fluid volume of this material. And I can't seem to get a hold of any material that is more concentrated than the, I think our stuff is 300,000 units per cc. So this is a major disadvantage. This is our drug of choice.
Let me just interrupt you and tell you that there is a more concentrated form of procaine penicillin available. It comes in 600,000 units per cc. But a more important fact is that the standard treatment now for gonorrhea in males and in females, as per the recommendations of the U.S. Public Health Service, is 1 gram of probenecid followed by 4.8 million units of procaine penicillin G in both males and females. And this is related to the increased incidence of resistant organisms to standard treatment. So that although this in the past has been recommendations, the recommendations have now changed so that one must give them even more drug.
And let me suggest this to you, that in urban Canada, where we practice, a study was carried out by Robson and his group at the Vic. As you know, we were at a, I was recently at a clinical day dealing with this subject, and they pointed out the incidence of resistant gonorrhea in this area, that is to say the resistance which requires much higher dose of penicillin, does not apply with the frequency with which it seems to apply in the States. And they suggested that these dosages are still going to be highly effective in Montreal, where this now, whether that's true across the country or whether you agree with it, I don't know.
That approach is correct. However, many authorities feel that a higher dosage is necessary to prevent the emergence in the future of resistant strains. And I think even in Canada today, the recommendations from the public health people are to use the larger dose of procaine penicillin. Bob, how do you treat your patients?
We, until recently, or within the last year, had been using a mixture of procaine penicillin and aqueous penicillin, Vicellin. But now we follow the recommendations of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, which is the ampicillin and probenecid routine, and all our patients are given this medication either in the office or in the clinic, and watched while they swallow it capsule by capsule. And we found that this is very effective, and in fact, we've only had one case who subsequently was positive on a follow-up examination, and in fact, we think that was probably a new infection.
The method of treatment that you've just outlined, probenecid 1 gram and 3.5 grams of ampicillin, a single oral dose treatment, is another acceptable method as advocated by the U.S. Public Health Service and the Canadian Public Health Authorities. And in our clinic, we've used this form of therapy almost exclusively in the last year, with a 96% effective rate. And in those situations where the patients which we would consider failed therapy, we were able to elicit almost 100% of the time a history of reinfection or possible reinfection. So we feel that it's a very highly effective form of therapy, and it's a very humane form of therapy, because the other one
amen to that
really hurts.
I suppose when you speak of percentage success, and especially in view of your remarks earlier about asymptomatic male gonorrhea, that you reculture every individual that you treat.
Right. These figures are based on reculturing them 1 and 2 weeks after treatment to be sure that they're completely cleared up. And in some patients, we even have a longer follow-up for one reason or another. So that, yes, this is based on cultural data. Well, what happens if the patient is allergic to penicillin? How do we treat them?
Well, there's basically two ways that I would treat somebody who's allergic to penicillin. I think if one likes to give intramuscular medication, spectinomycin, an antibiotic which is does not have the same cross-sensitivities as penicillin, and is effective against the gonococcus, and not effective against treponema, I think is a valuable intramuscular medication. for oral medication. I think oral tetracycline, given in a dose of 1.5 grams orally stat, and then 0.5 gram 4 times a day for the following 4 days, will be effective in treating gonorrhea in patients who are allergic to the penicillin.
Dr. Portnoy, we've been talking pretty exclusively about gonorrhea in this discussion of ours on venereal disease. What happened to syphilis?
Well, fortunately, the problem, the syphilis problem, although it has been increasing in incidence, has not anywhere paralleled the dramatic rise as seen with gonorrhea. And for every 200 cases of gonorrhea, we see one case of syphilis. So it's fortunately in our community a very rare infection. And when we do see it, it's usually in the homosexual population. So we're very happy about that because syphilis is certainly a much more serious infection than is gonorrhea.
You mentioned the now apparently widespread acceptability of ampicillin and Benamide treatment for gonorrhea, which is certainly a change. We've historically used procaine penicillin G for this. Is there any change in the guidelines of therapy for syphilis?
Well, I think the therapy for syphilis has remained really but the same. The standard treatment for both primary and secondary syphilis is 2.4 million units of benzathine penicillin G, 1.2 million units in each buttock. And this is a single dose therapy, and that hasn't changed. Unfortunately, many physicians confuse benzathine with procaine, and they treat their patients with gonorrhea with benzathine, and this is not correct. The treatment for gonorrhea is procaine penicillin. The question often comes up, what type of follow-up is required in a patient who is treated for gonorrhea in terms to rule out the fact that your treatment is interfering or delaying the emergence of syphilis and perhaps preventing you from making a diagnosis? The U.S. Public Health Service recommendation of procaine penicillin, 4.8 million units in Benamide, is accepted as adequate therapy for incubating syphilis, and they don't even recommend a follow-up VDRL after this type of treatment. They would accept that as adequate treatment for both syphilis and for incubating syphilis and gonorrhea. With the other forms of therapy, we are not sure. We think that perhaps the Benamide and ampicillin therapy is sufficient to cure incubating syphilis, but there are no hard data to support this point of view. And we recommend that patients who are treated with gonorrhea with forms of therapy other than the procaine penicillin should have a follow-up, at least one follow-up, and as long as 3 months after their treatment for gonorrhea. And if you wish to do it once a month for 3 months, that's fine as well. But I think 3 months after the treatment is probably adequate.
What about the patient who you suspect of having both gonorrhea and syphilis at the same time?
That problem hasn't come up too often, but when it has, I usually treat both diseases independently. And what I do is I treat the gonorrhea with oral probenecid and ampicillin, and then I give them the injectable benzathine penicillin G to treat their syphilis. You were mentioning that syphilis is not the only venereal infection, but there are other venereal infections. How often are we seeing trichomonas, Bob, and would you consider it a venereal infection? You mentioned before that you might.
I certainly do. I think almost all my cases that I see in practice are contracted sexually, although I think it's reasonably well recognized that other forms of transmission are possible. I think in a general gynecological practice that the trichomonas has to be by far and away one of the most common conditions that a woman presents with when she seeks a gynecologist, and certainly would be one of the two top infections that I see.
Bob, we tend to assume when we see a member of a married couple with gonorrhea that they've contracted it extramaritally. Would you make that kind of assumption about trichomonas?
Well, it has to
perhaps
start somewhere.
Perhaps my assumption about gonorrhea is wrong, but I don't think it is.
No, I think it has to, it just doesn't start up by itself, and I think it has to come into the relationship from one or other of the partners. I usually stress, I think Dr. Portnoy, mentioned earlier that he tries to de-emphasize the gonorrhea when he's treating a married couple, and I de-emphasize the sexual transmission, but I do say that once the infection is present in the female, that both partners have to be treated, and I routinely give medication for both my patient and her partner or partners. My record so far is.
What medication do you give the female, and what medication do you give for the male?
Well, again, I treat the female orally with metronidazole, and her partner with the same dose. But I also treat the female patient with vaginal metronidazole or a mixture of metronidazole and micostatin. Again, it's been my experience that very frequently, if you're treating either Manilia or Trichomonas, you eradicate one and the other one springs up. And I think that you save a lot of time if you treat them for both infections together. But
What dosage of metronidazole do you use?
We use one tablet 3 times a day for 10 days is my standard therapy for both male and female.
Howard, does a urologist see Trichomonas in male patients? Is that an easy diagnosis to make? Does one see it often?
One really doesn't see it often. I think one can have more suspicion of it being present if the patient gives a history of his wife having some vaginal discharge, and I think that it's the urologist has to look and see whether the patient does have a Trichomonas. I think that it's one of the things that can be considered as part of the specific causes of urethritis, but I don't think it's as common as it is in the female.
Do you see patients often who present to you with urethritis and whom do not have gonorrhea? How do you work these patients up, and what type of treatment do you give them? These are patients with nonspecific urethritis.
Well, basically, my feeling is that nonspecific urethritis is basically a diagnosis of exclusion. And there are many things that one can rule out depending on how aggressive one wants to be. I think one has to make sure that they don't have gonorrhea, that they don't have Trichomonas. If one wants to look for mycoplasma organisms, one should look for it. I think the treatment of nonspecific urethritis is basically empirical. The treatment with tetracycline with relief of the symptoms may lead you to the conclusion that the patient did have a nonspecific urethritis and you cured him. I think one condition that may occur in the male is what I call a prostatorrhea, which may give urethral symptoms, but is due mainly to prostatic fluid discharge, which may be normal or may occur after a specific infection. It doesn't really require any treatment other than reassurance.
Herpes simplex infections of the genital tract have been reported with increased frequency. Has this also been noted in your practices in terms of an increased incidence? Larry, do you see a lot of
yes,
that in your practice?
I see a fair bit of genital herpes. And, of course, the diagnosis isn't difficult to make if you see it in the classical situation with vesicles on an erythematous base and the classical symptoms of burning and discomfort and so forth. But, of course, sometimes they come before the vesicles appear, and then it's not so easy to make the diagnosis. But, yes, it is common. We all regard it as much more trivial, of course, and I know of no specific therapy. It would certainly be very popular if there was some specific therapy.
Bob, are you seeing this in your practice as well?
Yes,
how
I
do
am.
You manage them?
Well, I find a difficult problem to handle. Very often I find that it's confused with manilial infections in that they, with a severe manilial infection, you'll get ulceration or some sort of vesicle formation on the labia. I've been using Liquifilm.
Herplex Liquifilm
yeah. with very good results so far. But I usually seek the advice of other people too.
That's very peculiar because I have used that particular material, which was very successful when applied used for herpes keratitis, of course, for perioral herpes or male genital herpes, with very little success because you have to apply it, I think, practically every hour or two from the time the symptom first appears, long before the vesicle appears, and it's pretty difficult to get people to conform.
We've covered a lot of territory. There's one question that I often get asked by my patients, and that is, okay, doctor, I got it, you treated me, but how do I know to prevent it from occurring from next time? What type of advice do you have for me so that I don't get the infection again? Larry, what do you tell your patients?
Well, as I told you, I, for some freak reason, I don't see very many people with this infection. But of course, during World War II, they issued sailors as they went into port with survival kits, and those survival kits contain the well-known male prophylaxis. And to my knowledge, that's the that remains unchallenged as the only mechanical protection. There's one obvious answer, of course, but and that's to avoid contact. But this is pretty difficult unless one approaches it in a total and all-consuming way, which isn't attractive to anybody. So the male prophylaxis, I think, remains the only way.
Bob, do you have any advice about prevention?
Well, I would agree with Larry. I think that's I think the prophylactic is still an excellent means, not only of perhaps minimizing your risk of contact, but also minimizing the risk of pregnancy. But I find that, particularly in young people, that there's a tremendous aversion to the use of condoms. They really feel that this destroys the sexual relationship. It makes it too artificial, and there's a lot of resistance to using this type of thing.
There's been a lot of controversy about the effectiveness of the condom in recent literature as well, and that's principally related to the fact, I think, that men who use the condom use it not as a means of preventing venereal disease, but use it as a means of preventing pregnancy, so that they have sexual relations with the woman until the point where they're about to ejaculate, then they put the condom on, and by that time they've already acquired the gonococcal infection.
So or transmitted it,
right. I think if it's to be worn at all, it must be used from start to finish, and maybe then it'll be slightly effective.
This widely known fact does not seem to have mitigated the pandemic, however.
No.
That's because people are not using it.
Very good.